Just before we get started, the Second Act Podcast would like to acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on Treaty 7 land inhabited by the Blackfoot Nations. This includes the Siksika, Piikani, and Kainai. We would also like to acknowledge the Tsuut'ina and Stoney Nakoda First Nations, as well as the Métis Nations and all people who make their home on Treaty 7 land in southern Alberta. But now that we've paid respects to people that were here before us, let's start the pod.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Second Act Podcast, and today's guest is Heather Stuka.
Heather's story is not really something we've touched on much with the pod. I mean, she's obviously in a second act of her life, but that's because her son's gone missing, and her husband, 6 years later, haven't given up hope on trying to find him, just to get some closure. But her story was recommended to us by friend of the show, Phil Mason. And after sitting with Heather for an hour and chatting, I mean, what an incredible story.
Yeah, and these pods never cease to amaze me how people can go through such difficult and frankly impossible times and come out of it stronger and better. And Heather shows that even though she had something so traumatizing happen to her, she talks about it with such grace that you would think she's retelling a story that she heard.
Yeah, she does have that quality where it's like she's telling you a story, not her story. And I think that comes with practice and acceptance and all the things that go into it. But incredible story. Just could not have asked for somebody to be more honest about a change in her life that she had no interest in and wants no part of, but she's stuck with. So she's going to make the best of it. She's going to make the most of it. And let me tell you, man, if you listen to this story and you don't shed a couple of tears and you don't feel a little bit better about the world that we're in, with people like Heather in it, I can't help you. So without any further ado, let's kick it over to Heather.
Thank you.
We were just talking a little bit offline about how to approach this, and my experience with this podcast has been people who made these wide sweeping changes in their life because of something, you know, not always of their own doing, but they needed to make these changes. And you were in a bit of a unique situation, and this life altering change was foisted upon you and your family. And throughout that period and that experience, you kind of found a way to share that by writing a book and not keeping all that within you. And I'm just, first of all, I think it's an amazing thing to be able to do. But second of all, it has to have been a really incredible experience for yourself to go through all that.
You know what? I mean, I wish I could say that on the onset, I knew what my strengths were. I wish I knew that, you know, what my abilities were, the support that you would get. And although the book and my story is one like mired in grief, I think, and the book can be maybe a difficult read for people that were going on looking into it. I think overall, I'd love to tell people that it is a book about love. It's a book about a legacy. It's a book about community. It's a book about kindness and support. And those are all things that I think are just sometimes can be missing nowadays. And so I wouldn't have wished that this tragedy came upon us. I still think that there's lessons to be learned from them, and I'm grateful for them.
I think it's an incredible perspective. I mean, this is not that, this wasn't that long ago that you have all these years of experience and perspective, and yet you're still able reasonably quickly, I guess, to start to see some of that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what your story is and give us some timelines so that we kind of all understand exactly what we're talking about and the timelines that are in play.
So I would have said 6 years ago that, you know, I was ordinary, you know, mother of three imperfectly perfect children. You know, I worked at an airline, you know, life was going along well. I'd been married to my husband for, well, it would have been 22 years at that point. Like, ordinary, nothing extraordinary about it. It was a life of my own, a life of our choosing. And I think you always remember the moments before and the moments after when they change, and what is the catalyst for that. You know, had our oldest son, Ryan, was 20, had just finished a year of school and a year of working with my husband's company, and decided he wanted to take a year of adventure. And so he came to me probably about 6 months prior to when he actually left and said, you know, I was thinking about working at a ski resort for the summer or for the winter. Just go up there and be a lift operator. You know, I'm not sure what I want to do, and just wanted to have something. I wanted to do something else. And I thought at that time how extraordinary, because my son was very introspective, you know, close to home, never really left home. Same group of friends since kindergarten, really. And so, you know, when he mentioned this, I thought, oh, how amazing. Like, go for it. You know, try to see the world through a different lens. I was excited about him going. And then he left December 1st, gave us a kiss goodbye, packed his car, and left for a 9.5 hour car ride up to Sun Peaks. So we live in Beaumont, Alberta, and Sun Peaks is just outside of Kamloops, BC. So he drove 9.5 hours there and got a job as a lift operator, and had been living there with his friend for about two and a half months. And then on February 16th, he went out to a party after working, and then went to a house afterwards. All accounts, everything was fine, had a great evening. His roommates looked like they were getting up to leave at some point in the evening, and he looked like he was getting up as well. And then they left. It was about minus 26, and they looked behind him at some point and realized he wasn't with them. And they thought, gosh, you know, maybe he decided to stay. Maybe he's going to catch up with us, whatever. And they went home. And it wasn't until his manager had texted the following day, said, hey, is Ryan coming into work? He had never missed a day of work at all. And they found that unusual, and they sort of texted him back. But the manager wasn't able to get back to them until 7 o'clock that night. And by that time, she had said, no, he never showed up. And that started this whole concern, looking around to see where he might have gone. From that point, about 9 o'clock on February 17th, my husband and I got a text message from the roommate saying that Ryan never came home that evening and hadn't gone to work, and they were filing a missing persons report. And so my husband and I, you know, I want to say frantically, but I would have to say we slept. Maybe my husband didn't sleepwalk through the whole thing. I think I was in a daze at some point, but we ended up packing up and leaving that night and going up to Sun Peaks. And there we stayed for 4.5 months. I think that most people don't recognize that, you know, you'll get search, but there isn't anybody there from the beginning until whenever your loved one is found. And so we had one day of searching, although search and rescue did come back several other times, but one full day of searching. And then they came to us and said, we haven't found him, and we won't be back until there's a change in location, which means more evidence has been found that he's somewhere else, or if, you know, there's a change in the weather, which meant the snow melted. And at that point, and actually even to this day, 6 years later, Ryan's still considered just a missing person. There's no suspicious nature. There's nothing of foul play that seems to suggest that he met up with. He's just considered a missing person. And so, you know, they left that night, and then the next day you wake up and you go down to this command center that has, you know, was shifted back into their ski patrol. And my husband and I looked at each other and said, okay, so if our son is going to be found, it'll be left to us in order to accomplish that. And so for the next 4.5 months, we had over 1,100 volunteers come out. We had two buses that came from the Alberta area, as well as a plane that they fundraised for. And we had volunteers come and search. And every single day we had people going out, and we conducted searches. And from somebody that wasn't in our wheelhouse, was not our expertise, we had to learn really fast on how to do these things. And so I think that started this strength within us that we didn't know that we had, or maybe we had, And they came from different things in our lives, but you piece them together in the points that you need them the most. And I think that's what my husband and I, along with our friends, created is this this command center that hosted so many people to come in and search. And we searched every single day. And so we still go up there now and continue to search. That search hasn't changed. We haven't found him. But I would tell you, even though it was the most traumatic thing that we have experienced thus far, within moments of arriving in Sun Peaks, there was a barrage of information, like our friends contacting us, people that we'd known really well and people that we only knew on sort of the peripheral of our lives. And they kept, what do you need? And I think Scott and I in that moment said, okay, we are going to look for the silver lining in this, because anything else does not do justice to our son. He was a gift. And if I only think of this moment as a tragic one, then it negates everything that Ryan brought to us up until that point. And going forward, he's brought to us. So
that's an incredible, well, first of all, it's an incredible take on that situation, to sum it all up by saying that you're not going to focus on the sorrow and the grief, because it would negate any of the good. But I mean, throughout all that, you mentioned it yourself, like there was no playbook for any of that. You guys, and like, you're not a detective, you know, you don't have law enforcement in your background. You guys do other things. Were you just doing like what came natural as a parent, or did you have somebody that was able to kind of help you guys focus your efforts and understand, you know, where, how to even undertake something as big as this has turned out to be?
You know, I think for us, I'd love to say, you know, if you'd asked me again 6 years ago what my life would have been like if you had told me that this would have happened to our first and only, like, I mean, Ryan has my heart. He is my firstborn. He's everything to me, as both my daughters are. But if you had told me 6 years ago, I would have swore to you that I would have been in the fetal position. I would have been incapable of doing anything because my love for them is so great. And then when you're in the moment and you walk into this command center, and your RCMP, our law enforcement, had said to us the night before, like, on your way out of town either tomorrow or the next day, stop by the detachment and we'll tell you what our next steps were. And I don't think I ever processed that at the moment until I walked into that command center, and there's nobody there. There's nobody searching for him. And you're thinking, how can that be? Like, shouldn't there be somebody here every single day doing that? And in that moment, Scott and I had to put behind any grief that we had, any of those emotions. You had a car, you had to just put them in a box and then sit there and go, okay, what do we need to do? Well, we need a command center. We need to know what the conditions are. We need maps. And I think you just start thinking about it logically, and you're able to detach yourself a little bit from that. And even now I look at it, when I go and do volunteers and have them come, and I have to explain what they're looking for the long, I don't even think I've ever processed that. I don't know if I ever will until, you know, we find Ryan and bring him home. But you'd have to tell people, like, you're not looking for bones that you see on, TV. You're not looking for the white because they won't have been bleached by the sun. They're going to be the muddy color. You know, the you're not going to find everything, you know, there'll be wildlife. And after, you're just horrified that you think that you're talking about your child in those terms. Like, and so there's a lot of things that you have to be detached from in order to do this. And yet, you know, I always laugh, because if you had asked me before, again, I always say, if you asked me before, because I think it's how I always processed and how I viewed myself before Ryan. And I always thought, or had people tell me, you're too much. You know, you talk too much. You move your hands too much. You're opinionated. And I used to come up with different words, going, oh, I'm not, you know, I'm not bossy or assertive. I'm proactive. I'm not proactive. I'm dynamic. And I was like, okay, you're too much. And I think I always thought, oh, I should bring it down. I should change it a little bit. And yet those quality of being too much were exactly what I needed in that moment to be the kind of parent that searched for their child.
You brought up something that I had written down that I wanted to touch on. And that was the perception of something like that. You mentioned like the as it's portrayed in the movies and stuff and how society sees that. And it's obviously going to be very different from that. In that moment, was there any kind of where you could draw on things that you had experienced? Obviously not to that, you know, level and that close to home, but was there anything in the rest of your life that helped you with that?
You know, so I did work for an airline. So I was a guest service manager for WestJet. And as such, you know, you're often the last line of defense when you're dealing with your guests or customers that are coming in. And so, you know, for me, I always looked at my job as an opportunity to sort of think outside the box, because you get problems every single time someone would come to you. And, you know, I always operated from a level of empathy, or I tried to at least, and tried to put myself in other people's situations. And when the worst things happen for them coming to the airport, either they have expired ID, they've missed their flight, they've got the wrong thing, you know, whatever the situation is that, yes, the pat answer would be, well, you know, that is something that you were responsible for. Those are the things that you need to look for. You need to be on time. You need to know your, like, all of those things. However, that's not a very human approach when you're dealing with people, and especially when they're going through something stressful. And so I think that I adopted and was able to develop sort of this sense of empathy when I'm looking at situations. And so when I was looking at, you know, sitting in the command center, it was really important for me to thank people every single day when they came, look them in the eye and thank them for coming and taking, whether it was 15 minutes, whether it was 8 hours or whatever it was, thanking them for coming, because they didn't have to. But it was important for us to have those people there every single day searching. When I needed to look at doing command centers or doing interviews for press, that was important to make sure that, you know, that I was able to convey the importance of Ryan and why people should take the time out to come and look for them. If they know something, say something. Dealing with the social media aspect on our Facebook page, that takes a lot, because it's a double-edged sword. In the beginning, you know, you have all these people that want to support and they join, but they don't know you. They don't know the circumstances. They've never been to the area, and they certainly don't know your son. And yet there was a time and still now where people feel that it's okay for them to weigh in on their opinion. So what they think happened, you know, I was certainly, they created, because I was the only person, the spokesperson, my husband's not on social media. So I was the spokesperson, and in that you become the face of that, and that comes the good and that comes the bad. So, you know, I would get messages all the time, people judging me on, you know, how could you, looks like you washed your hair today. You know what I mean? Like, you look like you put on lipstick, like, you know, you ate today, or you look like you smiled, or, you know, that sort of thing. And then from that, from the judgment of you as a person of what you wrote, to the fact that you've impeded the investigation, which I'm not sure how possible I could have done that, but those sort of things, all the way to telling you the most horrific things that they think have happened to your son. And I remember saying to my mom and my dad when they came up and they were wanting to do the command center, and I looked at them and I said, in this moment, every single time you represent Ryan, you need to be more than you ever thought you could be, because it isn't about me personally anymore. So I don't take offense if people don't like me or my writing or the way we've handled this. I don't take it personally. It has nothing to do with me. We just need to become more. It's Ryan's legacy and everything about what we're trying to do and trying to create, not only for Ryan, but for other people that go missing, that don't have the same resources, don't have the same network. We're starting a blueprint for other families.
That's kind of into the segue of the next thing I wanted to talk about, and how you kind of morphed this from looking for Ryan into becoming an advocate for missing people in general. And was that, like, was there an aha moment where you realized I'm actually doing more of the advocation than the looking? Was it a general thing, or did you kind of wake up one day and say, I have this opportunity been thrust upon me and I'm going to take it in this direction to try and leave something better behind my terrible circumstance?
Yeah, I wish I could say that, you know, there was that aha moment and you're like, oh, how can I be better? But in actual fact, it was within the first couple of weeks of sitting in the command center, and someone said, oh, you should start a foundation or something where, you know, Ryan loved snowboarding, Ryan loved rugby, Ryan loved, you know, running, soccer. You should do a scholarship or something like that. And I'm like, yeah, you know, those all sound wonderful. And there is a scholarship for him at his high school, but that wasn't what was driving me. And I kept thinking, no parent should have to go through this, because none of us have a handbook for it. We don't know what we're doing. And those first, and while I will say every grief journey is unique to the person that's going through it. So whether you have similar circumstances of mine or not, I think that we all experience those first feelings of the same feelings, like the grief, the disbelief, could be anger, sadness, fear. I think that we can all experience that. We will do that once you get that first notification. Now, what you do after that is unique in a path your own. And I thought, no parent should ever have to go through what we're going through in these first couple of days, where, you know, everybody's crowding you, you're overwhelmed, they're offering help. Should I take the help? Do I know them? Is this help, is it going to be helpful? Is it going to be harmful? Like, how do you navigate through that when you are so grief-stricken? I wasn't sleeping, I was not eating, and trying to wrap your head around what has just happened. And you get all these people coming in and wanting to do something, and it almost seems like you're paralyzed. I'm paralyzed with fear if I'm doing the right thing, the wrong thing. Do I know what I'm doing? And so I just thought, if I could help another family not have to start from the beginning, that could be a gift for them. And so that's what we started. And we ended up meeting through that experience another family that had a missing brother. And 10 months later, they actually were able to recover his plane and were able to have closure. And from them, they gave some really good information to us on how to do some aerial searches and drone searches. And after, when I got home, we decided that we would work well together, because we had the same purpose to create this legacy, not only for Ryan, but also for Dominic Neron. That's he was in the plane crash. And so how can we benefit other families? How can we help them navigate through similar circumstances? How can we provide resources to them so they don't have to start at ground zero?
So it sounds to me like you guys, you know, you obviously had your moment of, you know, holy shit, is this really happening to us? And, but you very quickly, you know, were able to start putting one foot in front of the other and working through that. And the way you've spoken about it to this point, it seems fairly linear, like one foot and you did this and then you did this. I'm assuming that it wasn't, there was one step forward and two steps back and false starts. And what was that situation like? And maybe not like in the first little bit, because that, you know, time is money and everybody's so, but after you kind of accepted what has happened and what you're doing, as you start to get ahead and things happen, and then maybe weather turns you around, or, you know, life just happens, you have two other children, maintaining that purpose and being aligned. I'm assuming you and Scott have to have alignment kind of conversations all the time to make sure that we're still right. This is us. I'm going to write a book about this, and this is all going to come up again. We're all good with that, right? What was that like?
You know, I even within the first 3 weeks, like we thought we were doing it all one way because we didn't have any experience. And then we sort of fell into it where, you know, I'm walking along this, this sort of by the golf course, and we went over to the side, and there was just four of us, and we were digging out the snow. And then Scott was finished up for the day, and he's like, "Where are you?" And I said, "Well, we're over here." And so he brought the entire group of volunteers over. And at that point, we all did one area. And it was the first time in 3 weeks that I could look at an area and say, okay, I may not know where Ryan is, but I know where he's not. And right. he's not here. And so that changed our focus. And from that, I think we just, it was just another reminder that we have to be adaptable. We have to learn how to pivot. We have to learn how to go with the flow because we don't know what we're doing. There isn't a handbook. There isn't a guideline. There isn't something that says you're going to do this and this and this. And there's lots of times where, you know, we would get things. And because you're so frantic that any outside information, external information can throw you right off. And you have to be able to process that. And that was a lot of conversations. And we were lucky that we had such a great group of friends. So our friends traveled with us. They showed up the next day on that Sunday, and we had them start coming on Monday. And I would tell you there was probably mid-May, maybe first part of June, was the first time since we had arrived on February 17th that Scott and I were actually on our own. So there was always someone there. There was somebody living with us in a house that we had rented. My parents were there. We had somebody come every single week. So we always had people. And so maybe that was another benefit to having that, because we were able to share our experiences. Scott's would have been different from mine. I was in the command center for a lot of that time. He was out doing the searching. And so, and maybe that comes also with grief, how to process the grief and to respect the grief that each partner will have. Our grief is different. Scott, you know, is a fixer. He fixes anything. And for some reason, I think I rely on him to fix things. And it, not in this one, but I always thought, oh, I don't have to worry about it. Scott will figure it out. He always seems to figure it out. But he can't fix this. He'll never be able to fix this. Not through lack of trying, effort, dedication, or love. This is just not a situation that he's going to be able to fix. And that's not a judgment from me onto him. You know, I was impressed from the time that he got up, his day was exactly the same. And he had a lot of respect for me. There was no, oh, like you aren't able to search or you didn't search hard enough. There was that conversation. And so we were able to let each other grieve in a way that was healthy for each of us and still come back together at the end of each night and have conversations about how the day went and how we were going to adapt, pivot if we needed to, how the next day goes. And that's a continuation. So 6 years later, having those conversations with each other and with our girls is really important. Like, this is where we're on the process. How do you guys feel about it? Do you need anything additional from us? It's a lot of talking now, which is not a bad thing.
You mentioned the support system and the fact that you guys, you know, you went the first 90 days or so without having to tackle it by yourselves. And I have some experience with that too. We spoke offline before we started about my brother passing away and how that affected our lives. And that was something that, you know, came up kind of not unexpectedly. You always know you're going to have the support, but the depth and breadth of the support that you can kind of count on in those situations. But it never really changes the fact that when those people are done and they've come and they volunteered their time and you appreciate everything about it, they get back in their car, they get on an airplane, they go back to their life. And you're sitting there looking around going, but this isn't my life. Like I had my life and now this isn't my life. And you know, I'm not saying you ever harbor resentment, because I've gone through it and I've lived through that and I never harbored resentment, but it's not the same anymore. No. And that takes some getting used to. Was that something that as the people started, you know, the less people in your life, you were able to come to terms with that? Or was that kind of a stark reality on day 91 or whatever, when it was like, well, I guess it's just us?
I don't know if I necessarily felt that. I think that you know, I remember the night that Scott and I actually went out by ourselves into Kamloops and we went for dinner. I feel bad for the people that were serving us because, you know, we're fine. We're holding each other's hands. We're talking, having dinner. And then I start crying. And so I think, you know, they come and I'm like, oh, thank you so much for the, you know, the cocktail. And then I start crying. Yeah. And so, you know, it was definitely difficult. I would say that I liken it to us being on this train with no vista in sight. I don't know when my destination is. I don't know how long my destination is. I just know that my ticket gets me to the destination and there's no getting off in any other thing. I'll have some people come on this train. They have a ticket. Their ticket lasts for so long. Their ticket will come. They'll be able to come and go. Some people's tickets only last for a little bit. But at the end of the day, Scott and I will always be on this train until Ryan's found. And then we probably will be on a different train of actual grief. But people can come and go. And I get that. Logically, you get that. I think I wrote in August or September of the very first year is that I've learned how to lie really well. Right? Like, you know, people ask you how you do and you're like, I'm okay. And you're not, I don't know, but you can't live in my grief with me all the time. And I don't know how to explain it to myself. Some days I'm good. Some days I'm not. I wish I could tell you what days I'm going to be, what things are going to hit me, but you do learn after a while to lie really well.
Yeah. And I think that's probably the most relatable thing you can tell somebody about it, right? It's something that they can kind of go, yeah, there's been days where I've done that too. It's maybe not for the same reasons or the reason isn't of the same magnitude, but they understand that practice, right?
You know, I look at happiness. If, you know, if we were sitting in a room and, you know, someone said, oh, tell me your happy moments. And someone's like, oh, like I'm getting married or I got a new puppy or, you know, I bought a new house or, you know, having a baby. Everybody would look around and one person would say one thing and everybody like, oh my God, that's so amazing. That's fantastic. And somebody else would actually still say like, oh, that's wonderful. Let me tell you what's happy about me. And so you'll have this room and there'll be evidence of people being happy and they'll share it. There's no threshold. People will share the happy moments. It's the sad one. If we're in the exact same room and someone comes up and says, you know, my son went missing. It's almost like collectively the crowd will go, oof, like that is probably one of the higher places that you can be. Like, I've lost my job, I lost my house, you know, my marriage is not working out, but I can't share that because it doesn't match where that person is. And so I think we don't deal with loss and we don't deal with grief as a society very well because we don't use it to support each other. We think that we can't up somebody or that it has to be, I have to have it more than if I'm going to explain it. And I always think I would, from my perspective, I'm a gatekeeper of the knowledge from my experience. And as a gatekeeper, I should share that knowledge with people and not expect them to have the same level. If you've lost your dog and that's the hardest and most profound loss that you've had, that's unfortunate. I feel so awful for you. I'm human. I can't imagine that pain. I don't need you to experience mine for us to have a shared experience.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that kind of, until you've really been in the throes of it, you don't understand that the levels go away after, like, I got a speeding ticket on the way home, you know, and then after that, the kind of the levels just blend in together. You had a blog post that hit particularly close to me, to my heart, because my brother's accident was right before my birthday. His birthday was the day, his funeral was the day before my birthday, the day before my 25th birthday. And it really took the shine off my birthday for a long time until my kids got old enough that birthdays meant something again. And then it was a completely different thing. It was about them being able to celebrate dad and I didn't have to always think about Eric. And then you had a blog post about celebrating Mother's Day and it was profound. It was thoughtful. It was touching. It was all the things I wasn't expecting it to be. You kind of took it in a different direction. Do you want to just talk a little bit about that post and what went into it? Because I do believe that for every mom that's out there that's struggling with her first or 10th or 50th Mother's Day without a child, I believe there's something in there for them.
Yeah. I look, Mother's Day, we were up in Sun Peaks. That was the very first Mother's Day. And I know that at that point, we'd already gone through Ryan's 21st birthday, Scott's birthday, my birthday, Easter. And then we were moving on to Mother's Day. I'm still a mother. I'm still a mother of three children. And having Ryan go, I think I look at the whole thing just in general. And so I wrote about, having, if somebody could come and give me a gift and say, okay, Heather, whatever you want, of course, I'm going to trade places with Ryan, in a heartbeat, as I'm sure most parents would do the same. But I'm not going to be able to do that. That is not a gift that's ever going to be given to me. In the same breath, if someone were to come to Ryan and say to him, you have a chance to go back. I think that Ryan would look at everything that's been done in his name and in defining him in the last 6 years. And perhaps when he came home, came back, he would see life in a different way, maybe breathe a little bit deeper, love a little bit harder, those sort of things. But that is not an option that he's going to be given either. And so I always think, I'm going to meet my son again someday. I don't know what that looks like, but I just know that'll happen. And I never want to stand in front of my son and have him be disappointed in me and say, Mom, you squandered what I would have hoarded. I would have lived this life differently. Knowing that what had been done, knowing that I had this opportunity and I had a chance to redo things, I would have done it differently. And you had what I wanted and you squandered it on grief alone. You didn't even try. You didn't try. And so that has always stuck with me. I've always thought about that. So whether it's Mother's Day, whether it's Christmas, whether it's any of these things, I look in and go, it's not enough for me to survive. I want to find ways to thrive because that honors the love that Ryan had for us and that we had for him. I have two girls that need us. They, at that time, Juliana was 12 and Jordan was 17. We had already lost so much with Ryan, certainly with us being up in Sun Peaks and Jordan being at home trying to finish grade 12. That there was a lot going on, and they generously gave of themselves to make us not feel bad about what we were doing. But they had lost so much, and I didn't want to add to that. I don't want to take away their joy. I want them to find joy. I want them to have joy. I want us to celebrate those joyous moments with them. And Mother's Day was just another version of that, whether you have a child or have lost a child, just celebrating, I think, all that you are and that you were with them.
It's interesting that you talk about, honoring Ryan and celebrating him. When my brother passed, he was a 23-year-old kid. He'd been a rig hand, we always say that we were all college kids and rig hands. So we had we all got A pluses in partying. And, he passed away in the following May long weekend. The following year on May long weekend, we had a golf tournament, a memorial golf tournament for him. And it was 150 people. It was debauchery. I mean, it was barely sanctioned debauchery. And we did it for 10 years and it got progressively less of that because that's who we were. The first year we were not capable of fully, wrapping our arms around it. The 10th year, we had kids, everybody was in bed by 10 o'clock and that's how we were honoring him then because that's who it would have been. And you have to kind of take that into consideration that even though the child, the person isn't there, that it wasn't going to be the same as it was. And in 6 years, the sixth Mother's Day is going to look different than the first one. And I just thought it was such a unique take on on when it would have been so easy to just to take your, no one would have ever said anything to you if you would have wallowed in it. And you had such a great take on it that I wanted to bring it up, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about it, because I think it was a really, I don't want to say mature. You were a grown woman, mother of three, but it was a very mature take on the situation. And I'm not sure that a lot of people would have been able to find themselves with that strength in that position.
I think for me also, the fact that I was writing every day, maybe it wouldn't have been, but I was sharing so much of Ryan's story. And I think that what makes us different is the fact that we were searching for Ryan every single day. So I know that when you lose somebody, generally speaking, most people don't always bring up that past loved ones, their names. They'll see you laughing and they never really want to bring up their name, just in case they make you sad. And I'm like, oh, please always bring up his name. Like, you could tell me the same story every single day for 100 years. And on the 101st year, you'll tell me that story and it'll make me cry. That doesn't mean you shouldn't tell it. It reminds me that my son had an impact and that his impact was important. I look at the things that we do, and I think in general, and kind of go to that sort of philosophy where we'll mention Ryan's name. We mentioned him so often. We were able to talk about the funny stories, the things that made me sad. I was able to be reflective about the search functions that we were doing every single day, whether we saw him or not. There was just so much conversation that went around that I didn't keep inside me. It was very cathartic. And so maybe that helped that level of maturity, I guess, going through it, is that I was able to express it every single day. I wrote a post every single day for 4.5 months.
It's interesting you say that. I know if you go back to Carrot River, Saskatchewan in the summer, and you go out to the park, you'll never see more 40-year-old dudes crying than the ones that come back. You know, everybody's moved away,
yeah,
and they see my mom and they go and talk to her. And that's what it always ends up being, after, especially after a couple drinks, I think. That's what it ends up. And it makes my mom summer. I mean, yeah, Sitting there sobbing with Eric's friends, but she's like, they didn't forget him. They still remember him. Yeah. Right. And 21 years in or whatever it is, like that, I mean, that's the second best thing you can ask for. Right.
Yeah. There's so many fears when your child goes missing. There's so many fears, and those are uncontrollable for me. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know what those last moments were looking like. I don't know where he is. I don't know how to find him. Those are all things I can't control, and those are all incredible fears. But I think the one fear that I can control, but that would be probably most for anybody that's grieving someone that they've lost, is that the world will forget. That, you know, long after Scott and I are gone, there'll be no one there to remember our son, Ryan. And I think that, or even for us in our particular case, there'll be no one else to carry on looking for him. Like, I'd like to believe that even if it happened 150 years from now, that Ryan will eventually be found. And while we may not know and have all the answers, there would be least closure, whether we can benefit from that or not. But having people talk about him. So every year, Ryan's friends have come out to the lake, and so we'll do a weekend. They'll pitch their tents. So we'll play soccer at our lake, and I feed them. And we sit around the fire and we tell these stories about, and sometimes there'll be stories I haven't heard. And sometimes there are stories that we've heard every single year. And we're a very sarcastic family, probably with a lot of dark humor. And so, but we love hearing those stories. It's, you're like an archaeologist now, like digging, constantly digging to find some sort of bone about your child that you can hang on to, and you can go, oh, okay. Like, I thought he was a good son. Of course, you know, 20, how much could I really have known him? But to hear from his friends stuff, and hear these stories about when he was kids, and I love those. I love them all. Even if they make me cry, I love them all.
Yeah, well, that's the price of admission to getting to hear them. And the good news is everyone feels comfortable telling them to you, right? That's the part that makes you not think you did a pretty good job up to that point. Is he was friends with people that want to tell you those stories. I want to be respectful of your time. And normally when we wrap up, I ask people about their vision of success. And I don't know that that's quite the frame we want to put on this, but. But in one of your blog posts, you made a comment that said, not every movie has a happy ending, but some stories need to be told. And I thought that was a really incredible way to kind of sum up what you're doing here. Do you want to give us a little background on that thought, that quote, and kind of how you guys are framing that moving forward?
Again, when I talk about, you know, all the things that I could have, should have been or wasn't, and trying to change myself, I look at myself now. And I feel like I'm so much more than I thought I could have been. And I like that person. I like where I'm going. I like that tragedy has shaped me and that I allowed it to shape me. I think that you look and if you're water up against a rock, you can, you know, eventually you'll be smoothed, worn down, that sort of thing. And some rocks will break and not have that. And I'm glad that I allowed this experience, as bitter as it was, to help shape me and accept that. I wish, of course, that it was not at the expense of Ryan. So, you know, this is not a happy ending, but I don't, Scott and I never really want sympathy for ourselves, because this tragedy did not happen to us. It happened to Ryan. Ryan is not where he should be, not living the life that he chose, whatever that looked like for him. We are just we are the recipients of all these feelings and emotions. But we still want to honor him. We still want people to know his impact. And the book does that. The way that we search for him, the advocacy that we do for him, all not only helps Ryan, but also helps other families. And you know, what could be a better way to? There's no reason why Ryan's missing. You can't tell me that there's a reason in this world that will explain to me in any logical terms why my son is not here. But if there can be a purpose in it, if I can take a purpose and do something for the greater good, then it's my honor to do it.
The Second Act Podcast would like to thank Ben Sound for the intro and outro music, Happy Rock. We would also like to thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please like, subscribe, and give us any feedback you can. Thanks for listening.